start with you.
Okay. Well, good evening, everybody. Welcome to our select and distinguished audience, and to our distinguished speaker, Alan Bedding, who is going to tell us complicated things about how to mix up treatments, if I understand the summary right. And therefore, innovative statistical approaches for studies in drug combination development to treat infectious diseases. Over to you, Alan.
Thank you very much, and thank you for the invitation. Actually, it's just not that complicated. It's I've tried to keep the statistical bits to a minimum, so hopefully it'll be more interesting than complicated. But this is work that I and a number of others started around about September last year, or September, October. And as you'll see, it's still in its very conceptual stage. We haven't done any simulations yet. That's our next bits that we're getting on to. So this is really the ideas behind this and what we've come up with. But it has done quite a bit for the company. So as I mentioned, it's conceptual. We came up with these concepts, we've given this challenge, came up with a concept of a design. Then we had to present it to some very senior management. Before it got endorsed, we had to present it to an early development director who sits on the board of Roche, which was quite scary actually, because he just sat there staring, and we're thinking, why are you staring at? And then he just asked lots of different questions, threw out lots of questions. But it got accepted. I can't put the actual numbers up there, but the work itself has the potential to save the company around about 35 million Swiss francs, which is why it got senior management attention. Now we've been told, go away and do the design, work it up. You know, great, you've got the endorsement, now go away and do it all. But as you see, it's it's not that complex. I don't think it's any. Okay, so what I'm going to first go through, these are the sort of thing I'm going to go through, the problem with infectious diseases. Why did we do this in infectious diseases at the moment? What is the traditional development with infectious disease, how are they typically designed? Then I'm going to talk about this adaptive platform trial, which is what we developed out of this. And then the next steps. So the problem with a lot of infectious diseases, I've put examples in there, hepatitis C, hepatitis B. I'm going to talk a little bit more about hepatitis B in a minute, hepatitis E, and all of those the treatments for those diseases is around about 0 to 5% functional cure, which means actually even if you get some sort of cure, they have to stay on those treatments for the rest of their lives. They can't come off them, because once they come off them, the drug rebounds back to where it was previously. So it's not very good. It's really suboptimal. So what we're trying to think about is, can we combine treatments together in terms of coming up with this thing called an absolute cure. Now, absolute cure means instead of that being 5%, you're looking at 30, 40, 50, 60%, even up to 100% cure. So can we combine molecules to actually get to that stage? But what molecules do we want to combine? There are some existing treatments on the market. They're not brilliant. Do we want to use those in combination with new molecular entities, so new drugs coming through the pipeline? Or do we want to combine new molecular entities together to achieve this so-called absolute cure rather than a functional cure? So what we decided was, okay, oncology, in cancer, they already do combination studies. So can we learn something from the oncology pipelines? Can we learn from what they're doing in order to apply that in infectious diseases? So they already use many combinations for many different specific cancers. In fact, if you Google combinations in oncology, you'll probably come up with stacks of these things. The only difference is what they tend to do in oncology is they have a licensed medication, so they'll have a dose of a licensed medication, then they'll add something on top of that. So they'll add a new molecular entity, a new compound, on top of something that's existing already. Infectious diseases, that may not be possible, because what you're trying to do is get, actually, rather than a small jump, which is what you get in oncology, you're trying to get a massive jump. So we're looking for this eradication of the disease. Okay, so I'm going to talk a little bit about hepatitis B as an example. This I thought I'm going to do a screenshot from our website.
Just as a point, you may indeed come to it later, but what we're talking just now, the disease which occurred to me was herpes, which you can be infected with to start with, but then it lurks.
You can be a carrier for it,
You then become a carrier for it. So you could there indeed think of a combined treatment, A, to suppress the immediate infection, B, to seek out the lurking.
And that's one of the things you're trying to do. I mean, you're trying to do with some of these combinations, you're trying to quickly get in and treat the disease, which is going to bring certain antibodies down, but then you want that sustainable effect. But if you can get in and actually kill the disease completely, so you get rid of the disease DNA, which is the absolute cure, then that's the gold standard for any infectious disease. You want to try and kill the DNA that's behind the disease. One way we're actually thinking about doing this is by combining an antiviral with something that's going to boost the immune system. So that's another way of thinking about this. So I pulled this from, this was from our website. We have a Roche has a pharmaceutical arm. It also has a diagnostic arm. And we've been doing quite a bit of work in diagnosing hepatitis B for a long time, but we're actually moving more into innovative treatments. So it's an unmet need, and anybody wants to go on this and Google it, they can find out a little bit more about hepatitis. That's the liver. That's a massive organ, actually. You don't realise how big the liver actually is. So if we take hepatitis B in itself is a huge problem. There was a vaccination program back, I can't remember what it was, but it seemed to be missed in Asian countries, including China. So you're looking at around about 250 million people, in a third of those are in China, that are chronically infected with hepatitis B. So it's quite a big disease. There are also a lot of risk. Most patients that have chronic hepatitis B, they end up getting something, either cirrhosis or end-stage liver disease, or at worst, this looks horrible, that's a normal liver, that's what a cirrhosis liver looks like. So if you drink a lot, by the way, guys, that's what you'll get. That puts people off drinking for life, I think, when they see that. That's end-stage liver disease, and that's liver carcinoma, so that's hepatocellular carcinoma, so that's liver cancer. That's what it actually looks like. It's horrible. But this is what the existing therapies are looking like. These are the HP deaths in 1,000. That's where they don't have any intervention, but if they have intervention, it actually controls the disease rather than anything else. But this has to be kept on for life. They can't come off it, otherwise it just rebounds back up. So that's hepatitis example. The prevalence of hepatitis, I mentioned China already, you can see these dark areas are where it's highest. Obviously the UK is pretty low, the US is pretty low, so that's interesting. That bit of North America is quite high as well. The East, but Asian's quite, that's an interesting one, that piece of North America at the top there, whereas the main body of the US is pretty low.
How much would
a year's treatment cost? I'm not sure off the top of my head. I think the nukes are pretty cheap these days because there's generics that are out there.
There are a lot of people living up there, so maybe their percentage is...
That could be.
And also, in Greenland in winter, people spend most of their time huddled together indoors.
And it's that spread that... And the vaccine might not have reached these parts of the world either.
Yeah.
And that's what you think about, you think about the Asian countries, the African countries, the vaccine didn't reach these parts of the world. Actually, there's parts of Eastern Europe that are quite prevalent as well. I mean, Moldova is quite a big place for hepatitis.
So
really.
Japan also.
Yeah, it's different parts of Japan there as well. But also, this is coming back to your point, Ted, 75% of long-term carriers live in at the age of 70. So those that have got that long-term chronic, but they're actually just they're carriers, the disease hasn't manifested itself in them, they live in the Asia Pacific region. So this is the rise here. I think the vaccination must have taken place roughly around this sort of stage, but then you get this blimp, and then the treatments are coming in to treat these here, to treat down here. So I think the vaccination might have taken place here, but then if there was no intervention, it would have tailed off.
Why this rise would be the first place? Why was it concerned?
I don't know. It may have been the measurements. It may have been that they couldn't measure the number of deaths back here.
Still, the vaccination program is still alive in the world.
Still going. Yeah. In fact, if Nick was here, I could ask him about what GSK's vaccination program is like. This is what the current. So there's a couple of current therapies. There's entecavir to nonavir, and Pegasus interferon. So just call it an interferon. And these are the sort of response rates after a year and after 5 years. And you can see after a year, which is where most people have their treatment for, there's 3%, 2%, and 3%. It's pretty poor actually in terms of response rates.
Is there any difference between these 10 absolute?
There's very little absolute cure. You're looking at probably 0% absolute cure, because it doesn't. These treatments don't eradicate the DNA. They just control the. If I go back to this one here, this has got the way they measure hepatitis B is by this hepatitis B surface antigen, and the level of that surface antigen, and all these do is reduce that level of surface antigen. They reduce it and then keep it at a low level.
So functional cure is you're not having the symptoms of the disease, whereas absolute cure you're eliminating the
bacteria. Exactly. You're eliminating the background DNA of the disease.
And I think I missed the percentages in the previous slide. Is 8% of what of the population?
So that's greater than 8% of the population, I think, have it. And if you think, that doesn't sound like a lot, but it actually
it's
a lot of people. Yeah.
Now, I'm quite interested, the Greenland seems to be
8%. And I wonder if Greenland is one of those countries that didn't get the vaccination, like China didn't get the vaccination. I wonder if Greenland's the same sort of situation. And I'm not surprised that sub-Saharan Africa is very much the same.
Yeah, well, Greenland's a very interesting country because it's huge.
Yeah.
Very few people.
Yeah, so hence it might be 8%.
In Denmark, in the phone box, seeing the telephone directory for Greenland, and it was about 1/4 inch thick.
So they're not surprising, actually, that you've got quite a big prevalence of that. So this is 1 year of treatment. So they have a year, which is essentially 48 weeks of treatment.
But if you don't treat,
If they don't take this, then you've obviously got this where they've got no intervention. Their disease just gets worse over time.
When you're talking about reported cure, in what circumstances is somebody going back to their GP and saying I'm better?
It's more the symptoms, and they then.
What is the basis for collecting the data?
It is essentially to. At 3% is better than nothing.
What I'm wondering is, say, somebody who gets hepatitis in the first place is going to go to their doctor to get treatment.
Yeah.
But will they be seen again if it clears up? In other other words, basically your 3% only those who report back. Then there could be many who didn't report back because they got better.
Yeah, that could be the case. Yeah, yeah.
But they had to keep taking the treatment.
They have to stay on the treatment.
So
yeah.
Presumably they have to see the doctor to get the...
Okay, so are people who are still on treatment.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. So what I have in China, I have got a graph, not in here, but I'm sure I've got a graphic somewhere of patients that have actually taken the drug, then they've come off the drug.
If you don't take the drug, what's your life expectancy? So how many years? This is a slow disease. No?
It varies. Yeah. So I don't know exactly the number, but it varies from subject to subject.
Remember, we're talking about years, usually.
Yeah, we're talking about years, but yeah, if they don't take the drug, then eventually they will. Yeah, eventually they're more than likely to die of things like cirrhosis and that sort of stuff. Okay, so one of the points here, actually, I should have said that's 48 weeks of treatment, and one of these drugs are quite cheap. The newer drugs coming along are more expensive. So one of the questions is, do we have to treat for 48 weeks? Can we treat for less time than that? So you'll see in a minute that's one of the questions that we're trying to answer. Okay, so these are some of the questions. So combinations, what combinations do we want to go with? What treatment duration can go with 12, 24 or 48 weeks? That's the big, 12 weeks would be ideal. If we can treat a patient in 12 weeks and have the same effect or a better effect than what the current treatments have at 48 weeks, brilliant, we'll go for a 12-week treatment.
Do you also consider side effects in the sense that pre-drugs together may be worse in terms of side effects, but if you're only taking them for 12 weeks, who cares if you're...
Yeah. I'm not going to come on to that, but that will come into it eventually. Yeah. Obviously, as well, they're quite serious patients. Yeah, but they're quite... In terms of their condition, they may be relatively serious patients, so we're less worried about some of the side effects. We're not completely non-worried about, but less worried. I won't talk about investment gains. I'm going to come on to decision criteria, because that's an interesting statistical aspect in a minute, about how we define some of the statistical criteria. We started off with probabilities, but found that people weren't understanding those. The stakeholder alignment is more management. We had to talk to our management, talk to the management and then get feedback, and it was a backwards and forwards thing. But they said to us, do you know what, go away and develop some faster market clinical development science. That's what we've done. Okay, so the traditional development of these molecules, so if you have, let's say, three molecules, A, B and C, they all can be combined with each other. So you could have A plus B, B plus C, A plus C. You could have them all three together if you wanted to. You have the phase one development goes ahead. Then you'll have a 12-week trial, 12-week treatment duration trial, see if it does anything. It's a proof of concept type of study. Then you might look at a phase 2B, which is going to be looking at a longer treatment duration. And typically, you have a one-to-one randomization ratio, experimental versus a control. So that's what this is illustrated of. So you've got this first combination, you have a phase 2A, which is a short duration trial, followed by a longer duration. You might have a second combo that comes in. It's got a short duration, but it doesn't work, so therefore you kill it. Then you might have a third combo that actually is not developed at the same time as these two. And so you then do a separate study for that thing. Now the black lines in here all represent a common control. So if we do a one-to-one randomization ratio with these, you've got several different combinations that are being compared to the same common control. And that's an important point when I move on to the platform design. So these are some of the issues you have with this. You've got separate study teams, so you've got lots of FTEs that are being thrown into this. You've got this common control, which is maybe potentially wasting patients. It's resource, it's patient intensive. If you wanted to do a comparison of the combinations themselves, so if you wanted to compare combo one to combo three, you can't do it directly. You have to do some sort of indirect comparison, which becomes a little bit more cumbersome. but they are easy to analyse. So it's easy to analyse combination ones. It's easy to analyse these individual studies.
Is there some significance in the fact that you've moved combo 3 further to the right?
Yes. That's the significance of this is that there may be treatments that are not... So when we developed molecules within the pharmaceutical industry, there'll be some that are racing ahead, but there'll be others that are behind those. So in a traditional way, you can't start this at the same time as this because the molecules might not be available to go into that phase 2A study.
So combo 3 is something which comes up later?
It comes up later, yeah. And combo 2, the reason why there's nothing after here is we're saying this hasn't, in this short duration study, it just hasn't worked. But if I go back to this one. Yeah, if I think I've still got to do this comparison, the 48 weeks is a standard treatment duration, so I still have to, if I want to get this on the market, I still have to do some sort of comparison to make sure it's better than the 48 weeks. So think about that. The black lines are the real trick for doing all this, for now thinking I'm going to combine these together. So one of the things that I then went out and looked and said, okay, who else is doing some of these trials where they're combining things into one trial? Now the Berry consultants in America are doing this antibiotic platform trial. So this is the antibacterial resistance leadership group. It's a big name for a lot of fancy people, to be honest. But essentially what they're doing is they've got several pharmaceutical companies clubbing together to look at a huge trial which is comparing various different antibiotics with various different infection sites. I'm not going to talk too much about that, but that's quite, if you want to know a little bit more about platforms, that's where that comes from. So I've used work from this particular group, these ideas of platform trials from this particular group, but also some work that James Wason's done up at Cambridge on multi-arm, multi-stage trials and looking at adaptive randomizations and various things. So, you know, James has done some work in this area as well. I was hoping he'd be here today. So what we developed was this thing called, we called it an adaptive platform trial. And so as you can see from this, we said we've got one control arm. Now we've still got those different combinations, but they are all combined in one individual trial. And you're comparing to this common control here. But the difference being is what we've done is it's combined different phases together and possibly phase 3 as well. But it's also driven with various interim analyses. And I'll show you what those interim analyses do in a minute. That's where it gets a little bit complicated. So this, the whole idea of this is it is nimble, it saves time, and it does reduce costs. So we can fast track a lot. The dotted lines means we can think about fast tracking this forward to another stage. So we need less control patients. So if you think of the number of control arms, we've got one control arm. We suggested a 2-to-1 randomization ratio. But instead of just having the control arms in here, we have a lot of historical information. So can we then incorporate some of that historical information? And I know Nick Galway spoke about that, about using historical information in the last talk, so that's something that we can think about. It's attractive to patients as well, because if you think this is a 2-to-1 randomization ratio, patients have got better chance of getting an active treatment. So as a consequence then, you can tend to recruit more patients. Most of this is going to be done in China, but you've got to make it attractive.
Is the context also that this would typically be done within one company, so you haven't got the issue of release data from...
Absolutely. And the common control is something that is... you would include it in the trial, but the historical information, we already know what's out there, and we can use that information.
So Alan, it's almost that 3 studies you had previously is now brought into one study with one common thing.
Absolutely.
Or,
yeah.
Because now the third arm is starting still late, Yeah. And where's the control for that? You'll be using that.
Okay, that's a good point. That's a really good point, and I will come on to that in a minute.
Okay.
But yeah, it is just one trial now. And instead of having several protocols, several study teams, several different comparisons, you've got one master protocol. What we have now is what's called a master protocol. And that master protocol is kept open. So for example, this arm here comes in later. Then we just parachute it into the design. However, what we do is we also include a small number, we include a small number of the control arm in there to almost compare like a time effect in there, because obviously there's a time effect when this comes in. We need to then account for that time effect. But you're also then saying, okay, if it's the same treatment, if there's some comparability between the new arm, the extra bit that comes in here, with the overall control design, then we can bring those in together, and we can use some sort of Bayesian control to do that. So yeah, I'll put in there just we need to make for time effects when combinations come in later. So that's the effective platform part of this. What now makes it adaptive is the fact we do this horrible little thing, which looks. I'll walk through this, and I've got a few examples of what this is doing. So essentially, we would always have to look at that 48 weeks. Whatever treatment duration we look at, 12, 24, whatever, there'd always be somebody saying, well, 48 weeks is a standard. How does it compare to the standard treatment duration? So I've 30 patients is a rough estimate about how many patients we'll need for a direct comparison. But if you, this top arm, those 30 patients always complete the trial. So they always have 48 weeks of treatment, and they have a follow-up phase where they take them off the drug, and then they do a final analysis to see, you know, how is the effect being seen after they've taken the drug away.
There is a potential issue here that if you evolve the drug because there is an improvement after, say, 12 weeks, would the other drugs be followed up also beyond that, because some drugs may be slower to take effect but more effective when they do take effect?
Yes, and that's what you're hoping you'll get from this. And I'll walk through how we do the effect at 12 weeks, because that's quite an important piece to this design. So if we just take that, if we take that first bit, that there may be drugs that have an effect at 48 weeks, and therefore we hit 48 weeks. But there could be, so coming back to this, it may be that this combination, the optimal treatment duration for that is 48 weeks. It might be that for this one here, the optimal treatment duration might be 12 weeks. And that's entirely possible that could happen. So what we're doing with this trial, though, is we have interim analyses, IAs represent interim analyses, halfway of 30 patients and then 30 patients. And at each of these interim analyses, we can either kill the drug, or the go is not necessarily to go to the next stage, but it's more to open up another cohort. So for example, if we're seeing something that looks really good at 12 weeks, after only a small number of subjects, then we will open up either a 12 or a 24 week treatment duration cohort.
What was the criteria for ineffective?
I'm going to come to that.
Okay.
I will come to that. That's fine. But yeah, that's part of that.
That reverts back to my previous question, that the drug may appear to be ineffective at 12 weeks, but if you keep going with it, it may prove to be highly effective later on.
But then there is a risk that you might kill something that is effective. That's where our simulations are going to come in,
right,
to try and test that. But yeah, that's a very good point. We do know roughly when these should have an effect. It's whether we've then got to prove it.
I mean, you could think of a racehorse that's behind for the first 300 yards and then suddenly accelerates.
And all of a sudden you get to the end and you wish I hadn't stopped it. Yeah, no, absolutely. And so you could face that situation.
You mentioned roughly when things should have effect. Is that relating to this, because of a particular disease?
Yeah, and we know the mode of action, and you know, we've looked in animal models to say, okay, those two together have this effect in the animal. Will it translate to the patient? We don't know. In fact, it's interesting. I went to a conference a couple of weeks ago where they said actually in hepatitis B, the model animal models translate quite nicely to the humans. I'm not sure how true that is.
So the 12, 24, and 48 might differ for different diseases.
Different drugs, different diseases. They could, yeah, absolutely. So we do this at 12, when 15 reach 12 weeks, 30 reach 12 weeks, and we also do this when 50 reach 24 and 30 reach 24. But once we've got to that 24 stage, we know 12 is not going to be the best. Actually, if we don't kill it, and we don't, even if we do open up this new, if we don't open this new cohort, then this just continues on. So there could be a situation where actually we haven't killed it, but we haven't opened up a new cohort. We're just going to carry on the trial to the next interim analysis. So I talked about comparability of control data. There's lots of control data that we can use. So there's these drugs that are already on the market. There's lots of publications about entecavir, PEG interferon. They're all out there. We know what they are. So instead of using just the individual control data, we want to see if we can use some historical information in there as well. And I mentioned this small number of patients. So we bring in a new cohort, we'll also bring in a small number of control arm to take into account the time aspect. And I put one example. This is what the berries have done in there, is they've used a hierarchical model to account for, you know, if you've got these historical trials and then you've got the current study, this theta-3, then they all have some common distribution with the tau, looking at the dynamic borrowing between the trials.
Do you run a problem and find some drug has a benefit in some sense, so it would be unethical to randomise to placebo?
That's why, so the control is never going to be placebo in this.
Yeah.
Right.
It will always, so going back to the nukes, where the data was, so the comparison would always be to one of these.
Okay.
So it's the standard of care, rather than it will never be to placebo, yeah, because we can't ethically randomise to placebo.
At some point you might have to throw away some of your control data and you find a
Yes.
But you have a combination of, let's say, two or three, and you say the control is using one of them, well, it depends on which one. So you may have three controls, or probably...
We're only going to use one of those. It's probably going to be the PEG interferon, because we
commonly
Roche already do use PEG. Roche's Pegasus is a Roche drug, so that might be the one that we tend to use. We're going to use. That's still one of those things that has to be discussed as well.
That has to get approval from regulators.
Yeah.
Just to clarify, because I thought they were slightly confused. At certain point, the video slide, you said that 30 patients with which you start are going all the 48 weeks and then follow up.
Yep.
And then you said that at certain point you can stop the video.
Yep.
That means that some.
Yeah, so if we kill so I mean, obviously these patients are not going to all be coming at the same time. So this is more an illustration. You'll have some piecemeal, that some will get to 48 weeks. But once we have 15 and 30 and we've decided to kill it, then we'll stop the drug there and then, we'll probably re-randomise them to the control. But there's no point carrying them on if the drug's not working. So I'm going to show some examples in a minute of what the design might look like if you have an effect at the interim and effect at the thing. This is how we designed the decision criteria, not just at the interim analysis, but mainly the interim analysis. So we decided what we want to see in phase three. So obviously this is a phase two trial. Sorry, I should say this is a phase two trial. This is going to lead on to a confirmatory trial of what is the best combination. So we, instead of saying, well, instead of moving from phase two to phase three, we're starting with the end. So we're saying, what do we need to see in phase three? And given that's our target, what then do we need to see in, to give us a high probability of success for then what is going to be an on treatment decline? So this S-loss is the measurement on treatment. So you've almost got this, you don't want to take them off treatment. So during this trial, you're not taking them off treatment here. So you're doing this interim analysis on the on-treatment biomarker, the on-treatment decline piece, whereas the final analysis will be on off-treatment value. So we're using a sort of tree to come up with. So we're deciding what we want to see in phase two to trigger what might look like in phase three. This is decision criteria. This looks horrendously complicated when I see this now for the first time for the next aspect. But this is that. So if we think about the top line here, what we've developed is three criteria. We originally started, just to let you know, with Bayesian, nice Bayesian probabilities, and then we presented it to our senior management. There's no ears here. Senior management are not the most statistical. I don't know where you find this, but I find my senior management sometimes you just bang your head against a brick wall because they're maybe not the most statistical people. So you present nice Bayesian probability. So what we said was, let's have a probability that the value is greater than 1.9, is greater than 90%. They're like, I would understand that. What do you mean you don't understand that? It's easy, it's a probability. No, we had to translate this into percentiles. I think they had this problem with AstraZeneca as well. They had to translate things into percentiles rather than probabilities. I think it's interesting with physicians, what you'll find is they understand percentiles, but they don't understand probabilities. Yeah, I don't get it either, but that's what they taught me. So anyway, so we came up with three criteria. What we did is we had these sort of plots, which I thought were quite nice. They didn't like them. And we took those plots, we then decided, okay, what are the quantiles that we need to have above? So 50% needs to be above a 0.5 decline. I've made the decline positive. 30% needs to be above a 1 decline, and 10% to be above a 1.9 decline. And if you get none of these are satisfied, actually if you never satisfy the medium piece, you're going to kill the compound. Whereas if you satisfy just one out of these, then you've got this sort of evaluate. This could be a where you get together and discuss and go, oh, okay, it looks good, but then let's carry it on. If you hit the medium piece, but one of these others, so it's taken into account not just the point estimate, but also the tails as well, the distribution, then you then go to this go. And once you've got to this go, then you evaluate it in terms of, can I open up a week 12 cohort or week 24 cohort? So if the loss rate is greater than 50% patients, then you activate this 12-week treatment cohort. So it gets a little bit more complicated. So you've got two different criteria. Hence, this is probably the most complex bit. Now the extra complication that's going to come later on is we've decided that we can't use this for every one of our molecule, every one of our combinations. So some work in different ways. So we're going to have to adapt this to look at different combinations.
Just one point of interest: you mentioned using Bayesian priors for the control.
Yeah.
What is the source of the priors?
Okay, so going back to this. So these theta and these priors will be derived from the historical data. So we'll start off with some non-informative priors, but then we'll use these to look at the borrowing within this.
Basically, it's from a control.
Yeah. So it's from the historical control.
Yeah.
You mentioned specific reference. Complicated.
Yeah.
Obviously, they left your expectations for the base failures.
So yeah. So these, I these then lead to what we want to see in phase three. So these are derived. So we take phase three. This is what we want to see in phase three. If we want to see this, we want to get good, so we want to get a high probability of having phase three success. This is what we want to see in an off-treatment response rate. But if we want to see that in an off-treatment response rate, then this is what we want to see on treatment.
And what exactly was the what is the target for that data? 30% success, 50% success, 10%
success. So that response rate there we're looking for is 30% response rate.
Okay, your next table is sort of approximated for 30% success.
Yes. So if we see that, so what we're saying is if we were to see this, then that would equate to, if we took that to a response rate later on.
And if you wanted 50% success rate.
If it was 50%, then we'd have to, these have, would have to be higher.
You would adapt.
Yeah.
Just to clarify what the 0.511 for that, are they sort of scores on a particular there, change?
It's actually
index.
A continuous endpoint. So these are. This is a continue. This is the value of a biomarker. So this is a continuous endpoint that goes from, I think it goes from zero to something. So you get drops. If you give the drug, you get a drop in this biomarker, and that's what these represent.
When you discuss it, obviously you have some specific expectations about this clinically impossible, what is clinically meaningful.
Yeah.
It is specifically hepatitis B. If it was not hepatitis B, but hepatitis C or D, would you change these numbers?
Yes, you potentially could change these numbers. Yeah.
Because the generic title of the sort of form is infectious diseases at all.
Yeah,
and
so
viral infectious diseases of liver and then specific hepatitis B.
So I think this is more specific for whenever you with these infectious diseases. You're always going to give a treatment to try and treat it, then if you take it away the disease comes back, and what you're hoping is actually that disease is not going to come back and you're going to get some long-term response. So this is probably...
I think the methodology is equally applicable. This is just those targets can change.
Yeah. The methodology is what's important as opposed to the individual targets themselves. And like I said, what we started with was this. We plotted out what we want to see, and said, to a physician, is this what you're thinking about? And then, if we take cuts of this, if this is the decline given the drug, then you take cuts of where this might actually occur, where you might want to get a median above and various different bits and pieces. That red line, by the way, represents where you're killing the drug. Okay.
The previous slide, the one before.
That one.
Yeah. We set the targets for that first block, and we are making decisions at the far corner, right?
Yes. So this is what we're doing.
That's where we actually make decisions.
Yeah.
Based on these targets, right?
Yeah.
What was sort of multiplicative factor from that to this one?
I haven't got it here, but there is something there.
That's a tricky business as well,
yeah,
to work out that business.
Yeah.
There's always,
there's a factor that goes in for that adjustment.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. So these are examples of what it might look like. I said, come back to the kill version. If we see this, then we're going to kill it. Then we're going to kill the molecule. And this could happen when an NF15 gets 12 weeks. So that's the example where you might just kill the drug. This could be the example where you've done the interim analysis. It satisfies the criteria for the go, and now it satisfies opening up a 12-week duration. So not only do we have this arm, but we also have this arm as well. And plus the control arm as well.
And this has to do with the dose of patients in the first group or something like that?
Sorry, this has...
So the extra branch?
Yeah, these are a new lot of 30 patients.
Yeah, but that's because you lost patients from the previous group? Or?
No, because these 30 will carry on here. This will be another one. So this is a separate example. So this is where, it doesn't work. We just love that. I'm going to come to him in a minute, what you've just said, because there's a really good thing you've just said there, which is what happens if you kill this compound? What can you do to this patient? So I'm going to come to that in a minute. So this is a new arm where 30 patients get treated for 12 weeks, then it's followed up in the same way. So you can do this direct comparison between the two. That's a similar one, but you actually just open up a 24-week cohort duration, and that's if you flip it along. So what they've done here is they've gone to the 12 weeks. They can't open up any new cohorts, so you go to the 24 weeks. But now, yes, once you've got to 24 weeks, you can then open up this cohort.
That doesn't make sense to open 24 weeks after 12 weeks. Maybe it's better to wait till 24.
Potentially, what we're saying here is that if this drug here now is starting to look like our control would have done at 24 weeks, then we're going to open up this 24-week duration. I know what you're saying, it almost doesn't make any sense. You want to wait, you maybe get to 24. This is probably hedging our bets that we're going to be pretty good at the 24 weeks.
Well, the faster market principle in the pharmaceuticals, we always push to
shorten the duration, get as short as possible. But this way, the one good thing with this is you're driving off data. I'll show you what one of the alternatives that we are asked to consider in a minute doesn't drive off the data. So the whole aspect of this is it's data driven. It's all driven off what you actually see during the trial. These are some of the, we were asked to put together pros and cons of these designs. The pros look great for the platform design. The one thing I remember when we did the pros, we put statistical methods more complex, and senior management were like, if it's more complex, how are you going to analyse it? Being statisticians, we just said, do you know what, let us deal with that, you deal with the rest of it. But there is lack of internal, in fact there's probably lack of experience with these studies, full stop. And we don't know at the moment how this is going to be accepted from the health authorities. So we haven't presented to the FDA, we haven't presented to the EMA, and most importantly we haven't presented to the Chinese regulators.
Talking about that, of course, these approvals from authorities, because they found that it's quite difficult to get absolutely good things. And they now practicing, at least in America, is taking it. They are practicing sort of provisional approval.
Yeah.
So if you have encouraging an update, that it's provisionally approved, conditional on sort of medical
aid. Absolutely. And one of the things it's one of the things we're looking. You know, we know that regulators want large amounts of safety information. For efficacy, we know we don't need a huge number of subjects. So we might end up getting that sort of conditional approval. The one thing this does is it saves this PVC cost is basically the patient costs. So you essentially when you've got four separate studies, it's not surprising that you're going to save patient costs because you've got you're bolting four studies to one. And it also saves on the number of people you have to support it. If you've got three separate study teams, you only need one study team to do this. Okay, so that was the alternative. We were asked to consider different alternatives. And the management, sorry, yeah, go ahead.
There's a practical piece. It does look attractive, but obviously it'd be the center that would be capable to enroll all the patients at the same center. How do you do
it?
Previously, get away with several centers that don't have to coordinate. And now it should be, is it possible?
It's one of the considerations we're looking at is can we do it in a single center or a multi-center? We are looking at multi-center. That then makes the statistical methods eminently more complex.
So far, this has been a new style of design and not really yet any reference your combination of treatments.
Yeah, that's maybe a remiss of me. I haven't really mentioned how we're going to do the combinations.
Right, okay.
And I'm not going to, so I do apologise for that one.
I was just wondering where it might come in.
Yes, no, it's more around the design.
Okay, to the point of your question.
It's more about the designs and the combinations. It is in a way, yeah. So yeah, but it's more how we do the combination development than anything else. This was the alternative we were asked to consider. And that if you look at this, this is basically doing, instead of doing that adaptive trial, it's saying we start with all three of these arms. We have the control in there as well, and it is simple. It's simple to compare this with this with this, and then compare it with the control. But if the 48 weeks is the best treatment, then we've wasted essentially 60 patients here. Whereas if we go back to this, if nothing works in this 24, the 48 weeks is still the best treatment. We've still just got one arm and 30 patients. So that was a wasted. That was something that came into it. The other aspect that we're also thinking about is, can we do this in? So that's the phase two. What can we do then for our pivotal trials, our phase three trials? The endpoint in our phase two is the same as the endpoint in the phase three. So you could do potentially this seamless phase two, phase three design. So instead of doing this phase two followed by this phase three, forget the words placebo in there, you could just bolt these together and do one massive seamless phase two, phase three design.
That might increase chances for if you were to do complex numbers from the phase three, if you have collected the appropriate complex numbers data in phase two,
There's lots of challenges. That's why I didn't want to mention that too much. There are lots of challenges with this, including the fact, okay, when do we look at the phase two results are available here where you can review them. They're not going to be available in this scenario where you bolt everything together. Okay. So as I mentioned, well, this is a concept. It is a concept. It's been accepted from a senior management perspective. We've now got to go ahead and fill in the details. How are we going to bring this to full development? So we have to do things like simulate, define the operating characteristics. I mentioned previously, well, the decision criteria are some sort of generic decision criteria at the moment, but we're finding when we're looking at the preclinical data and some of the early data, we're finding actually we might need different decision criteria depending on the different combination we're having. We're still going to present to the regulatory authorities. It's going to be presented at various external meetings and conferences. In fact, I'm presenting it in 2 weeks' time at the PSI conference. And we keep getting this question, how are you going to make this work? That's the big question. That's coming back to the multi-centres. You've got the control arm. You've got the different study teams. You've got various different things. How are we going to make all of this work? And that's something that we're doing this year. That's potentially, there's a lot of work this year going into putting all this together. That's what I was going to talk about. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I'm sorry I didn't talk too much about the combinations.
Yeah. Well, again, that was a flashback to the herpes example.
Mm.
When you first captured that child with chickenpox.
Yeah.
That would get an immediate treatment to alleviate that, but then the virus embeds itself in your nervous system, and then you might get infected with some bacteria, which then stimulates the virus to emerge and give you herpes. So you would be using then a combination of treatments on the second occasion, and you might be interested in, should you start with the anti bacterial, follow up with the antiviral, or vice versa, or both at once, whatever. The combination of treatments question arises in that very simple case.
Yeah, yeah. And like I said before, I touched on it a little bit when I talked about what we are trying to think about is you've got direct acting antivirals, but you've also got things that will boost the immune system. So essentially you're killing off the virus, but what's then boosting the immune system is actually keeping the virus at bay. Now coming along later on, probably in about 5 or 6 years' time, companies are now developing molecules that target the DNA specific, but they're in such an early phase they can only do it intravenously into animals, and it's killing off some of the animal DNA as well as the virus DNA. So there's a lot that needs to be refined, but they're certainly developing things that will just direct the DNA of the disease itself.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. So, because you say success, how do they measure that the patient is cured?
So the measure they use here, so they use this thing called this surface antigen. In hepatitis B, they measure the surface antigen. You give something like entecavir, the surface antigen drops to a certain level. It only does, I think it's a 1 log drop. And it's not very, that's not very good. What you're looking for is sort of 3 to 4 log drops. And the surface antigen gets to a certain point when you say, yes, it's a response. Now, what you want to see once it starts responding, if you take the drug away, you want to see that stays at the same point, or even better, that you get this thing called seroconversion, which means it's actually the disease is fighting, or it's been cleared completely, and the antibodies are coming back in. So you have to then, you have to measure this by biomarker assessments.
And what considerations statistically you would make if it is different? If it is different combinations, your decision criteria will be altered.
Yes, different combinations are having different effects in our preclinical models.
Right. So what are the changes status-wise? Where do you focus changes?
They'll probably change. So if I come back to here, let's go back to that decision slide. They are more likely to change this here. So instead of it being 0.5, you might have some drugs. If you think these are, I think these are log drops. So if you think of what we're trying to do is maybe get a drug that gives a 3 log drop, and some of our drugs, we're seeing that in preclinical models, that might be 3 logs that we're trying to get there. That might be a 3, so you'll change this here. So essentially it's moving that to the right hand side.
I try to sort of summarize myself in a short way. No details, but the general idea of what you say. In my understanding, I'm trying to say how I understood the background.
Uh-huh.
But the basic idea is, instead of doing pre-designed trials with a certain number of current patients and certain duration, you are thinking about how to change, probably increase number of patients, depending on what we see during the trial.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's absolutely it. So instead of having several different trials, you're putting all those together, and then you're using the data as an ongoing basis to drive what you want to compare later on.
And the Bayesian aspect is just the reuse of historical information, or there is something.
It's more the reuse of the historical information. What I didn't say as well is that there are, get back to that slide there, the patients that are going to come into this trial are either going to be naive to treatment, or they're going to be on a current therapy. So they will have been non-responders on current therapy. Now what we're thinking of doing is, if they go on here, so this is not Bayesian, but this is we're going to recycle those patients if they don't respond. So if they don't respond on this therapy, if they're naive at the start, then we're going to recycle them onto potentially the active arms that are being treated. Now that presents another problem.
Can I just have an explanation? Naive to treatment means they've not been treated yet.
That's not been treated yet. Yeah. So they've been diagnosed but not been treated.
Non-respondent means they've already been treated but no effect.
That's right.
And so those are not the same kind of group.
They're not the, yeah, no, and this is where, we might end up having an analysis where we have to account for those in the analysis.
Because non-respondent implies a resistance to treatment in some sense.
Could be, yeah.
Whereas naive to treatment, you're likely to have some who would respond.
Some who respond, yeah. No, that, again, that's coming back to this, one of those things we need to think about discussing.
Indeed, it's a good point. Important factor.
Yeah, yeah, it's a good point.
Always the patient population, number one.
Yeah, and I guess if you start winding down by, okay, we just want those that don't respond, you're somehow shortening the, you know, you're reducing the patient population.
Do you think you will use that trial and some simulated data to make that cutoffs using the cost series that you get?
Yeah, yeah. So the way these are derived are actually from a Bayesian analysis of the data. Yeah. We've just translated them back to percentages. In fact, the way these were derived was we did a meta-analysis of some of the control data that we have in-house that we can then we've gone and we said, okay, this is what it's producing, this is what we want to do over and above of that current standard of care, therefore these are the numbers we're going to have to see.
Perhaps it's time for the speaker to go silent.
Thank you very much, Aaron. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you.
Thank you.